All right, welcome everyone to Didactic Mind, episode 40, I believe. Yeah, I believe it's the big 4-0 today. The new Cold War. I am Didact. Very warm welcome, as always, to all of my readers from the blog. Very warm welcome to all of my SoundCloud subscribers. If you have not already subscribed, please hit that subscribe button so you never ever miss a new upload of either the Didactic Mind podcast or the much less regular and somewhat more rambling, perhaps, domain query series, where I answer questions posed to me by readers and by commenters. And if you want to support my work, as always, head over to superbshaving.com, and links are in the description box, where you will see a number of articles that help you choose the best products for your traditional wet shave. If you have not already started with wet shaving, make that change today. It will be something that will stand you in good stead for the rest of your life. You will never ever go back to cartridge razors and the horrible feeling of daily razor burn. You will never ever go back to cheap substandard plastic products. You will never go back to alcohol-based products that irritate your skin. You will instead have the knowledge and the ability to use products that will give you a great shave every single time. You'll save a huge amount of money. I mean, we're talking hundreds of dollars every single year, which adds up very fast. And most importantly, you won't be sending a lot of money to a very woke corporation, or at least a woke subsidiary of a corporation. And full disclosure, I happen to own shares in Procter & Gamble. So when I say that Procter & Gamble has some serious problems with its shaving unit, with Gillette, its men's personal hygiene product or unit, or basically its Gillette subsidiary, if you will, I'm not joking about that. The reason why Gillette launched that ridiculous toxic masculinity ad campaign in the first place is because the last time I checked, when they did this a couple of years back, the global head of marketing for, or the North American head of marketing for Gillette was a paper American. Let me go look it up, actually. The best a manlet can get. I remember actually writing an article about this. And let's see, what was his... Yeah, his name was Pankaj Pala, and he is, with a name like that, he ain't American. And if you actually go look him up on LinkedIn, let's just say it wasn't a very good idea for him to do that. I believe he's been transferred since then to somewhere else. He's in Geneva right now, rather than in America. And for the sake of North American customers, that's a very, very good thing. Anyway, the point of today's podcast is to discuss the burgeoning Cold War between the USA and China. And a lot of commenters have, on various political blogs and YouTube channels, have stated very plainly that this is a war that America can win as long as it does not go hot. And it is a war that America will lose if the shooting actually starts. And I think it's worth taking a look at this new Cold War through the lens of the old one. And in order to understand how the Cold War was won, the original Cold War, you have to look at the history of how the USA and the USSR interacted with each other going all the way back to the 1930s. I'm not going to give you a full history lesson about it because that would take too bloody long and ain't nobody got time for that shit. But if you look at the foreign policy of the USA toward Russia from about 1918 through to about the 1930s, basically what we're looking at is a policy of more or less active disengagement. The USA just really didn't care about Russia too much. It's too far away. America had already gotten what it wanted from Russia in the form of Alaska, and that had been a full couple of generations before. So the U.S. really didn't have a dog in that fight. If the Russians wanted to do what they were doing on the continent, that was Europe's problem. Throughout most of the 1930s, the USA actively disengaged from global politics because, of course, the US had its own problems. It had a president in charge in the form of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who very much wanted to get involved with political matters in Europe, but couldn't, because he was too busy wrecking the economy in the US at the time. And by the way, anyone who tells you that FDR saved the USA from the Great Depression is flat out ignorant. And at best, he's flat out ignorant. At worst, he's a liar. Because no modern serious school of economics in any modern university seriously believes that FDR saved the country from the Great Depression. He didn't. He made it much, much, much worse. It is still taught in high schools that FDR was the savior of the country and that his economic policies staved off a much greater collapse. It's absolute nonsense. There are a number of myths that emerged from the time of the Great Depression that have taken 70 plus years to squash and disprove and dispel. I myself have fallen for some of these myths. One of the most important and incorrect is the idea that trade tariffs deepened and prolonged the Great Depression. Excuse me, they did absolutely no such thing. If you actually look at the hard data, I mean genuinely look at the data before and after the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act was enacted, the data show that the drop in trade from the Tariff Act was not nearly enough to have caused the consequent drop in GDP that the United States experienced in the 1930s. And, more importantly, the drop in trade was nowhere near the subsequent drop in trade in the late 1930s from additional tariffs that were, not additional tariffs. There was an additional drop in trade and GDP, which, as far as I can tell, happened without any additional tariffs. And if you don't believe me, I mean, that's fine. You don't have to believe me. Go look up Vox Day's Return of the Great Depression, in which he slices and dices this argument. It's an argument that I've heard time and again from Gene Smiley, from Thomas Sowell, of all people. Great economist. He's just turned 90 recently. A man for whom I have immense respect. I mean, one of the foremost academics and economists anywhere in the world, legendary figure of the right. The fact that he's black has absolutely nothing to do with it. He's just an incredibly talented and gifted writer who has a very hard-hitting, no-holds-barred, no-prisoners-taken sort of style. It's almost confrontational, the way he writes. But he got this completely wrong, and he persisted in getting it completely wrong, and continues to persist in getting it completely wrong. And I don't care who he is, if he's going to persist in getting it wrong, he deserves to be corrected. So that has to be corrected for the record. The Great Depression was not caused by a global drop in trade tariffs, and that's going to be important for later on when we talk about the God Emperor's War, the God Emperor's trade war against China. I should say, of course, his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, the Lion of Midnight, may the Lord bless him and preserve him. Because that's genuinely what I think about him. The God Emperor is a legend among men. He's proven to be actually a huge disappointment in some areas. And I'm not happy about that. If I were him, not that I would be, but if the world somehow someday comes to its senses and elects Didact, or more likely, you know, is basically in no position to resist when the Didact takes over as supreme ruler of mankind. If I were in that position, I'd be doing a hell of a lot more to enforce the law, throw out illegals, shut down the borders, stop people from flooding into the US, basically telling everyone else to F off, we're full. Tossing out paper Americans, because there are an awful lot of paper Americans in the US right now, and telling them to go back home. Because that's what's necessary to fix the USA, or to give the American empire, as it is right now, a fighting chance of survival. I don't think that's possible. The American empire is going to collapse one way or another. It's a heterogeneous collection of nations held together by force on the old geographical footprint of the United States. And there is an old Chinese proverb, which is rather fitting and apt and apposite in this situation. I think it comes from either the Romance or the Records of the Three Kingdoms. For those who aren't clear about the difference, the Romance of the Three Kingdoms is the fictionalized, embellished, legendary account of the records of the Three Kingdoms. The Records of the Three Kingdoms dates back to, I think, the very start of the Han Dynasty. My Chinese history is a little hazy about this, but I think it's the very start of the Han. It was a period in which the Zhou, the Han, and the predecessors of the Han, and somebody else were basically at war with each other. And eventually the Han won out and created the basis for what is today's China. The existence of the Han Chinese nation can be traced back to those events. Now, the saying in the Records, or Romance of the Three Kingdoms, goes something like this. The empire that is united must break apart, and the nations that are disunited must come together. I'm butchering the quote horribly, but that's the essence of it. That's not my reading into it, by the way. I haven't read more than the first, 20 pages of the Romance of the Three Kingdoms. I got that from our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, peace be unto him, Vox Dei. So it was in one of his dark streams, and he made that point. Now, going back to the interactions between the US and the USSR at the time, the USSR did not play much into US politics up until the outbreak of the Second World War. Now, the funny thing is, Roosevelt, as detailed in Amity Schlesinger's book, The Forgotten Man, was actually quite pro-Russian, as I recall. He was anti-German, deeply anti-German. He really didn't like the Germans at all. But he was quite sympathetic to the Russians, for reasons that I forget. But basically, he wanted to get involved in a continental war in Europe. He really did. He had no reason to get involved. He had no excuse for it. But he desperately wanted to get involved, despite the strong objections of the House of Representatives and the Senate at the time. And because of his screwing about with the economy, he lost control of the House and the Senate, even though they were controlled by many of his allies. Towards the end of the 1930s, the Republicans gained significant political advantage and were able to stymie a lot of his more stupid efforts to control ever more of the economy. So he wasn't able to muck around in Europe the way he wanted until the outbreak of the Second World War, at which point he was able to start supplying arms and expertise to the Russians. Now, the Russians under Stalin, what was their situation? Horrible, as any Russian will tell you. Stalin, oddly enough, is still a revered figure in Russia today. Something like 20 to 30 million Russians out of a population of 147 million still revere him and still think of him as a great leader. But overall, his reputation has been greatly diminished through time. Most Russians do not respect him, do not like him, and with very good reason. When you end up killing 50 to 60 million of your own people through war, famine, disease, starvation, and, of course, the infamous gulags, well, that tends to take the shine off a man's reputation pretty quickly. But for a long time, Russians really revered him. Now, the Cold War between the USA and the USSR developed, of course, after the fall of Germany, in which the USSR drove through much of Eastern and Central Europe, most of it, in fact, and stopped in Berlin. And there was significant desire on the Allied side to continue the war and to fight against Stalin and to drive them out of Europe. The Americans didn't have any appetite for it. The British public didn't have any appetite for it. The French absolutely didn't have any appetite for it. The only person really clamoring for it was Churchill. Now, Churchill is not the hagiographic figure, or the legendary figure presented in the hagiographies that we are accustomed to. It is well established at this point. If you read A.J.P. Taylor's The Origins of the Second World War, and more importantly, in a more modern context, Pat Buchanan's The Unnecessary War, you will very quickly realize that Churchill is the reason why Hitler tried to attack Britain. Churchill is the reason why unnecessary atrocities were inflicted upon the German people by British Bomber Command. Churchill is the reason why the war became the hell that it did, in Europe at least. He is at fault for so much that went wrong in Europe, it's not even funny. Churchill was not the great leader that everyone thinks he was. Again, I mean, time has shown that a lot of what we consider to be true history is wrong. But over time, Churchill evolved into the kind of leader that Britain needed, even though he was also responsible for some of the biggest disasters and policy foul-ups of the British Empire during the Second World War. Now, by the time 1945, 1946 had rolled around, Europe was in a state of stalemate. And that was towards the end of the 1940s and start of the 1950s. That's when George Kennan wrote his famous long telegram as X, and basically advocated for a policy of containment, because he understood what very few people in the American political establishment understood at the time, that the USSR was a profoundly dangerous state actor, an extremely dangerous one, and would stop at nothing to destroy Western liberal democracy, Western republican ideals, and Western ways of life. And he understood that the USSR needed to expand constantly and consistently in order to avoid dealing with its own failures. If you look at the economic contradictions of communism, there's no way that communist societies survive without outside help. Well, ironically, the USSR only survived because it was propped up significantly by the US, the UK, and much of Western Europe. If that had not happened throughout the 1930s, then the USSR would have collapsed out of, you know, just sheer ineptitude and stupidity. That policy of containment persisted all the way through to basically the 1960s. By the late 1960s, it was clear that America had no appetite for containment any longer, because containment effectively meant confronting the Soviet Union in various theaters of war and various diplomatic engagements. Basically, it was an attempt to coexist, because the U.S. was too weary from war to desire going into Russia, invading it, conquering the USSR, and it would have been a fool's endeavor anyway. Say what you will about the Russian military, but one thing that they know how to exploit is the vast territory of Russia and the frankly horrid climate, at least in, you know, for 7 months of the year, it's horrid. The Russians know how to take advantage of that. And almost all invaders of Russia, except for basically the Mongols under Subhatai Khan, have failed to invade Russia in winter. And have failed to conquer Russia, and especially conquering armies from the West have failed to make much of an impact. If you don't believe me, just ask the ghost of Charles XII of Sweden, if you can find where he was laid to rest after Poltava. Anyway, the result of all of that containment and the failures of the policy of containment was appeasement. First there was détente in the 1970s, where Nixon and Kissinger came up with a philosophy that said, we believe the United States of America is in long-term decline, and as such, we need to come up with a realistic political framework in which both nations can coexist, or both powers can coexist. And as the U.S. strategically retreats from these places where we have no interests, the USSR needs to be given incentives and kind of ways of existing that we can provide. As long as they stay out of our sphere of influence, we'll stay out of theirs. So it was basically another attempt at coexistence after the failures of the Vietnam War and the enormous internal struggles that racked the country at the time. And after that, unfortunately, was Jimmy the Idiot Peanut Farmer Carter's attempts at basically making human rights the mainstay of U.S. foreign policy. I don't know what he was thinking, but my God, what a moron. And he made a complete hash of it, as it was expected. And Jimmy Carter's legacy is not quite as bad as everyone thinks it was. I mean, most people don't realize this. Most people on the right certainly don't realize this, but deregulation actually started under Carter, not Reagan. And of course, the various fighter programs that Reagan eventually took credit for started under Carter. The F-117 stealth fighter, actually a bomber, but stealth fighter, that was Carter's work. That happened under Carter's watch. The F-15 Eagle, the F-16 Fighting Falcon, a lot of the groundwork for this stuff was laid down in Carter's administration. It was Reagan who came along and took all that to fruition. And now we come to St. Ronald Magnus of the Right. Genuinely, I mean, a great man. The greatest president of the 20th century. Ronald Magnus. Now, everything I've told you is available in a film called In the Face of Evil. Phenomenal movie. I mean, it's one of my absolute favorite non-fiction movies. It's a documentary film, co-produced, interestingly enough, by Stephen Bannon. You may recognize him as the former advisor to the God Emperor, who was fired for basically leaking internal secrets and being kind of an ass and a glory hound, and whose reputation has since been greatly diminished. But he did co-produce that film, and it is a phenomenal movie. In the Face of Evil basically talks about Reagan's war in word and deed. And the film is based on a book by Peter Schweitzer called Reagan's War, which is one of the best books on politics that I personally have ever read. I'll leave links to all the stuff that I'm talking about in the description box. You can go check it out. Pretty much everything I'm referring to, except Pat Buchanan's book, I've already read, so I haven't read Pat Buchanan's book, it's on my reading list, but basically, all of this stuff I'm talking about, I have personally read or interacted with, and it's well worth going over. So if you're at a loss as to what to do during the summer, you need some reading tips, go check it out. Now, Reagan's War lays out the template for how to win a long war like the Cold War. And it lays out the template for how to win this Cold War. If you break down the Gipper's strategy, it rotated along, or it evolved along four parallel lines of attack. The first was economic. The U.S. exploited its vast economic power, and Reagan's personal belief, which actually turned out to be vindicated later by CIA analysis, that the entire USSR's economy was not really much, was actually smaller than that of the US alone. The US on its own could outproduce the entire Warsaw Pact. And the USSR's economy, like Russia's economy, just Russia's economy, was really not much bigger than the size of California's. And they spent half their money on defense. Half their money, half their output was spent on their military. So he basically exploited the vast firepower of the American economy to outspend, out-innovate, out-produce the Russians. That's where the massive rearmament program that the U.S. undertook in the 1980s really broke the back of the Soviet military. They couldn't keep up. The ex-Soviet generals themselves will tell you the reason why their military failed was because they couldn't keep up with Star Wars, the SDI program. They couldn't keep up with it. That was what really broke them. The second avenue of attack was diplomatic. The U.S. essentially created a coalition of free nations to go in and resist Soviet aggression, confront them, and united its allies around the world, democratic, freedom-loving nations, and provided aid to Soviet dissenters within the landmass of the Warsaw Pact. Lech Walesa, who was at the head of the Solidarity movement in Poland at the time, has since gone on record stating openly, without Ronald Reagan, the Solidarity movement could never have gotten its message out. With Radio Free Europe, the Voice of America, all of these platforms that helped them get the message out to people, they couldn't have done it. The third axis of attack was military. And by that, I'm not talking about the rearmament program. I'm talking about actually going out there and aggressively confronting Soviet incursions into the American sphere of influence, wherever they happened. Panama, Grenada, Nicaragua, in Africa, providing arms to basically anyone who resisted the Soviets. In Afghanistan, providing arms and Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen. Which turned out to have been a pretty stupid idea in the long run, but, seemed like a good idea at the time, right? And the fourth avenue of attack was basically oil, oil and natural gas. The idea was to crush the one resource that the Soviets depended on. Well, the main source of hard currency, oil and natural gas. Reagan instituted tariffs, he tore up trade agreements. He basically said, we will no longer supply wheat and grain to the Soviet Union. The Soviets couldn't feed themselves. I mean, you think back to 30, 40 years ago, this seems shocking in today's context because Russia is today the biggest or second biggest exporter of wheat to the entire world. Back then, they couldn't feed themselves. That's astonishing because Russia is home to some of the best farmland in the world for growing agricultural crops. But they couldn't feed themselves because of their idiotic communist policies. So Reagan tore up those agreements as part of his economic sanctions drive. But then secretly he sent Bill Casey, the head of his intelligence unit, the head of the CIA, to Saudi Arabia, where he had some very strong ties with the Saudi monarchy, and he convinced the Saudis to double their oil production and crater the price of oil pretty much overnight. This destroyed the Soviets. I mean, they had no hard currency, and it got to the point where, by about the mid-1980s, they knew they had to make a change. So when it came time to elect a new chairman of the Communist Party, it came down to a showdown between the hardliners and the reformers. Mikhail Gorbachev, that's how you pronounce his name, by the way. Mikhail Gorbachev. The stress is on the last vowel. If you know anything about Russian, you'll know why. Gorbachev was put into power by a margin of one vote in the Politburo. In the Politburo, that one vote was Yuri Andropov. And Andropov voted for him. He was one of the hardliners. He voted for him because he understood what the other hardliners didn't. That the Soviet Union couldn't survive without somebody like Gorbachev. And that's how the Cold War eventually was won. Now, what lessons does this give us for today's Cold War against China? China has some unique vulnerabilities, and they need to be exploited. They need to be attacked. Let's be clear about something. China and America are not friends, and they cannot be friends. Historically, China has been much more the aggrieved party than the aggressor. Okay? Historically, that's absolutely been true. China as an empire has more or less, throughout most of its history, been like, we are the Middle Kingdom, we are the best in the world, no one can touch us, you are the insignificant, inferior rest, we don't care about you, bugger off and do whatever you want to do, don't touch our territory. They went into self-imposed isolation for 400 years thereabouts because they thought the rest of the world had nothing whatsoever to contribute to their success, their technology, their happiness, etc. They were proven very rudely and badly wrong by the West in the mid-18th century. From the 1830s onwards, it became very clear that China had become stale and feeble, as stagnant powers tend to do. But today, China of today is not the China of the Ming or the Tang or the Han dynasties, obviously. China today is the China of the Communist Party. The Communist Party of China is absolutely an avowed enemy of the West. It is not Western, it cannot be Western, it will never be Western. It does not share the three pillars of Western civilization. The Greco-Roman philosophical legacy, Christian morality. Anybody who wastes my time in the comments with Judeo-Christ, I'm gonna delete that instantly, because that's bullshit. There's no such thing as Judeo-Christianity. So don't waste my time talking about that stuff. I've refuted this a number of times. It's Christian morality. And the third pillar of Western civilization is, of course, the European nations. None of these three things apply to China, okay? China will never be Western. And if you look at things through a spiritual lens, there's probably good reason to believe that there is a watcher, one of the Nephilim, if you will, which I talked about in a previous podcast called Who Watches the Watchers, which will make sure that these influences never reach China. So the Communist Party of China is definitely an avowed enemy of the West and has made that very clear through its actions. How do you resist an opponent like China? I mean, you can't attack China militarily. China has hypersonic missiles, which we know are a very effective deterrent against American supercarriers. China has the world's biggest standing army. China has the world's biggest standing air force. There are, however, a number of major weaknesses that China has, which can be exploited by the West. And again, Reagan's war helps us understand what those weaknesses are and how to exploit them. There are at least three avenues of attack with China. The first is economic. Again, it's always the economy that matters here. The thing is, everyone thinks that China has an incredibly powerful and strong economy. It really doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. If you look at China's actual economic statistics, 400 million people now are part of China's middle class, and there's a very small sliver of ultra-rich people numbering in the dozens or maybe tens of millions, okay? Dozen million, few tens of millions. It's basically a drop in the bucket compared to a population of 1.4 billion, thereabouts. The great sort of unwashed masses, however, are still desperately poor. There are still about 800 million very poor people in China. On top of that, China is aging extremely fast. It's the fastest aging society on Earth. Their fertility rate has dropped to about 1.2 children per woman. This is well below the demographic black hole of 1.6 children per woman. The demographic black hole is a concept that's been discussed in social sciences for some time now. It's an observed total fertility rate level below which no country in recorded history has ever increased its population naturally through natural, native reproduction. It's never happened. Can it happen? No, I don't know. I mean, the Russians are trying. Some indications are that they're succeeding. But so far, at least, even the Russians recognize that their total fertility rate is way too low. And they're trying to jack that up using immigration. Not a great idea, in my personal opinion, but, you know, Putin doesn't care what I think, and nor should he. China, on the other hand, has some very serious demographic problems coming up over the next 50 years. They don't have a social safety net. They don't, well, they do now, you know, somewhat. But they didn't have much of a social safety net for many, many years. These days they sort of do, but not, it's not much of one. And yet, they still have a very traditionalist model where the parents look after the children look after the parents when they get old. Well, that's all well and good when you have a family of like four or five children and one of the children stays at home and looks after the parents when they get old, that's fine. What happens when you only have two kids? Okay, one of the kids, let's say the son goes off and tries to have a successful career, and has a family of his own, and he moves out of the house. I mean, in non-Asian societies, that's what happens. In Asian societies, the sons tend to stay with the parents. The daughter leaves the house for sure, definitively leaves the house. That's very common in Asian societies. The daughter will leave and join her new family. So what happens when you only have one child in the house? Okay, then you got a bit of a problem. Because now you have one child, which is the result of China's one-child policy, upon whom all of the hopes of the family rest. Well, you got a big problem. You got a huge demographic time bomb. Now, there are those on the right, Vox Dei among them, who say that this whole idea that birth rates determine destiny is nonsense. If the Chinese want to, they can always force their women to have children, which that's true. They could do that. I wouldn't put it past the Chinese. Anyone who thinks that the Chinese in general share Western ideas about human rights and human freedom really needs to go visit China. And even if you go to places like Singapore or Taiwan, you're going to be in for a very rude shock about societal attitudes from Chinese-derived peoples about human rights and freedoms. They don't care about that stuff anywhere nearly as much as Westerners do, because they don't have a tradition of it. Now, the economic angle is further enhanced by the fact that Chinese productivity is abysmally low. This was referenced in a talk dating back to 2015 in an Australian think tank. Two university boffins, one of whom is actually ethnically Chinese. He's Australian, but you know his family is originally from China. Talk about how China will probably not become the dominant power in Asia, and it's fascinating because it looks at China from both the economic and the military sides. And the Chinese guy is a specialist on the economy, and the Australian, the white Australian chap, is a specialist on the military, because he's got an intelligence background. I'll link to the video in the description box and on the blog. Fascinating stuff. Really brilliant talk. It's an hour long, well worth listening to in full. The Chinese chap talks about productivity in China. It's appallingly bad. Chinese productivity was and still remains to this day lower than that of India. And India is an astonishingly inefficient economy. Think about that for a moment. If you look at India with its, I mean, just appalling levels of work safety, its atrocious infrastructure, its useless, predatory, bumbling, stupid government, its government really is a plague upon its people. If you look at its work culture, its problems with the caste system, its well-known issues with actual high-quality education, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, the list of social problems in India is enormous. If you look at all of that, and then you look at China, and you realize that the Chinese have a lower rate of productivity than India does, that should tell you something. It should tell you that China's so-called economic miracle is founded upon very shaky base. The Chinese do have made tremendous economic strides. There's no question about that. They have. But if you look at the Chinese economy, it's on very, very shaky ground. There are entire cities built in China for no good reason. They perform no function. They're ghost cities. There is a gigantic debt bubble brewing in China, which they cannot easily quell. If you look at the statistics about China, yes, they have tremendous foreign exchange reserves. Yes, they have about $2 trillion of American bonds that they're holding. Yes, they have all of these financial resources that they deploy. Yes, their problems are nowhere near as big as those of the U.S. I mean, if you look at the total amount of debt in the U.S. economy, it's several thousand percent of the total national debt, of total national GDP, I should say. If you add up all of the debts, present and future obligations that the Americans have, it's in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. The U.S. economy right now is only about $22 trillion in size. It's several multiples of the U.S. economy. But here's the thing. Most of that stuff can be deferred until much later. I mean, most of it comes in the form of Social Security payments, which, let's be honest, you know, a lot of people who are depending on Social Security for their retirement, they ain't going to get it. Not going to happen. If you look at China, on the other hand, their total debt outstanding is probably on the order of 300 to 500% of their economy. That's a terrifying statistic when you realize that the Chinese have relatively limited financial weapons that they can deploy to fight it. They don't have reserve currency status. They don't have oil. They don't have natural gas. They don't have resources that they can use and mine in order to get out of this trap. They don't have the economic power and base to do it. Therefore, when you look at the Chinese economy and you look at the fact that the Chinese economy basically functions as a manufacturing hub for the world, this is not a position of strength. It's not. We are already finding out, because of the Kung Flu, that manufacturing can be offshored to places like Vietnam, India, Japan even. China's advantage does not lie in manufacturing. It really doesn't, because you can get cheaper manufacturing elsewhere. You could go to Thailand, where the cost of Thai labor is like one-third what it is in China, maybe less. You can go to Indonesia, you can go elsewhere, and you can get high-quality products made for less cost than you can in China. What is the appeal of China as a manufacturing base? Well, it's the fact that intellectual property rights are very, very diluted, that stuff gets done quickly, that they have a very authoritarian culture, and here's the dirty little secret that the Chinese don't want you to know, slave labor. Like all communist societies, the Chinese have a major system of slave labor in operation, which helps them keep their costs down. If you actually go by official Chinese, you know, wage rates and stuff, they're not that competitive, and you can outsource to other countries. That's the economic angle of attack, and because of the Kung Flu, a number of nations have already chosen that angle of attack. The second is military. The Chinese have an overwhelming military presence, that's true. They have the world's largest standing army, the greatest number of tanks, pretty much, maybe that's Russia, I could be wrong about that. I'll have to go look it up, but the Chinese definitely have a massive advantage in terms of pure manpower. They have the world's largest air force. They now have one aircraft carrier that they bought off the Russians. They're planning on deploying another two. They have hypersonic missiles, which they can deploy against approaching American aircraft carriers. If an American carrier battle group goes into the South China Sea or sails to defend Taiwan, we know what's going to happen. Either those carriers are going to get annihilated by a barrage of hypersonic missiles or the other various defensive systems that the Chinese have in place, or they're simply going to turn tail and run. And at that point, that's the end, the definitive end of the era of the supercarrier. It's done. Do American military planners recognize this? Well, maybe, but you wouldn't know it, judging by how much money they're sinking into these stupid, idiotic, unbelievably dumb turducken planes, the F-35s. If I start talking about the F-35, we're going to be here all day, so I'll try to shut up about it, but it's just such a dumb idea. I can't believe the Americans did it, but anyway. However, the Chinese military is much weaker than most people realize. It's not an efficient fighting force. It's not well equipped. I saw some commenter on the right talking about, it was an article I read this week, talking about how China's armed forces are better equipped, better trained, and better prepared for war. Who the hell comes up with that nonsense? That's ridiculous. The average Chinese grunt is equipped with less than $3,000 worth of equipment. How much equipment is the average American grunt equipped with? And we're not talking Marines, we're not talking special forces. We're talking about just the average soldier in the US Army. $18,000 worth of equipment. Most of a Chinese infantryman's equipment consists of his rifle. That's the most expensive thing that he's got, the Chinese bullpup assault rifle. Not a very good rifle, by the way. Certainly not compared to the American M16. Certainly not compared to whatever it is the British use, the SA-80. SA-80 after the Heckler & Koch reconstruction. These are not good weapons. They're crap, actually. They have inferior weapons compared to the Russians, the Americans, the Brits, the Germans. I mean, the Germans can't source enough guns to equip their forces anyway, but even the Indian military has better rifles than the Chinese do. If you look at their air forces, yes, they have the world's largest air force. Yes, they have the J-20 Chengdu, quote-unquote, stealth fighter, which is a blatant ripoff of the F-22. But does it actually function in combat? No, it doesn't. Here's why. Here's a dirty little secret about both the Russian and Chinese militaries, which they don't want you to know. The Russian Su-57 is a superior fighter in almost every way to the F-35. But the Russians don't have the engine technology necessary to achieve supercruise speed. Not yet. They've been struggling with that engine technology for years. They can't steal it off the Americans. They don't know how to make it themselves. They've been struggling for a long, long time. It's very, very hard to make an engine that will achieve supercruise speed, which is one of the specifications of the Su-57. So right now, even though it's a brilliant fighter in a lot of ways, it's very underpowered. It can't achieve the performance figures that it's supposed to. The same is true of the Chinese Chengdu. Now, this is where one other aspect of American strategy comes in. The Americans have technology that the Chinese want. They need to steal it. They can't create it by themselves. This is one of the major weaknesses of China. They have very limited capacity for innovation. They've increased it of late. They've gotten a lot better at it. There's good reason to believe that the Kung Flu that we're all suffering under right now is a direct result of a bioweapons lab accident, and the evidence seems to point to that now. It wasn't a deep state operation from the US that led to a global pandemic. It wasn't a zoonotic transmission. That theory has been basically discarded. It's becoming increasingly clear that the COVID-19 virus probably escaped from the Wuhan research facility, the P4 lab that they have, which failed containment and it got out in the public. And if that's the case, then China bears some serious culpability for that. So get rid of China's ability to steal technology and you cripple their ability to produce advanced military hardware. Let's be clear, the Chinese don't just steal from America, they steal from Russia too. They've ripped off Russian fighter designs, they've ripped off Russian tank designs, they've ripped off Russian naval designs, quite happily. The Russians don't like this. Another dirty little secret of the Russian-Chinese relationship is that it's one of necessity. Here's the thing. The Chinese consider everything basically north of the Amur River and everything east of the Urals to be their territory. That's a huge amount of territory. It's basically all of eastern Siberia. They consider it to be theirs. They consider it to be part of Greater China. They've already bought out huge swaths of Siberia. The Russian people already complain about how much the Chinese have taken over in that region. But the Russians basically depend on Chinese money to keep large parts of their economy afloat. That doesn't mean that they like the Chinese. Putin's relationship with Xi Jinping is one of necessity. It's not one of genuine friendship. It's one where he recognizes that Russia is a weaker partner, and that's the reason why the Russians have been steadily beefing up their land warfare capabilities. The Russians are probably, at this point, the second best land warfare fighters in the world, next only to probably the U.S. Marines. Maybe the U.S. Army, depending on who you're talking to. But basically, the Russians have no real ability to fend off the Chinese if they invade. That being said, the Chinese are not militarily all that strong. Their own internal reports reveal that the Chinese understand their fighting forces aren't of high quality. And if you look at the fighting history of the People's Liberation Army, number one, it's not a very good fighting force. It never has been. Its fighting record is abysmal. It barely survived initial contact with the Japanese. It was content to stand back and let the nationalists, the Kuomintang, soak up all the casualties and do all the fighting against the Japanese. And once China had been liberated by the KMT, the CCP then sent in the PLA to overthrow the KMT. KMT fled to Taiwan. Their record during the Korean War is appalling. They basically pioneered the human wave tactic, where they would just throw huge numbers of soldiers against American guns. They lost 10 Chinese to every American soldier killed. Their record against even weaker opponents is pathetic. They tried to invade Vietnam in the late 1970s, which is something most people don't know about. They were handily beaten back. They were thrown out of Vietnam very quickly by their supposed, you know, putative erstwhile allies. They have engaged in border skirmishes with India along the line of actual control in that sort of disputed border region near Nepal and Tibet. The Chinese have refused to release actual casualty figures. The Indians have. They release their own casualty figures, but the fact that the Chinese refuse to release casualty figures should tell you something, given if you know something about how Chinese culture of face-saving works, they know damn well that if they release their casualty figures, they'd look like fools. And the official Indian estimates are that China lost at least twice as many men in those skirmishes compared to the Indian side. So, who knows? But the Chinese do not have effective fighting forces, not really. They're not battle-hardened, they're not tested. They're good for showing off on parades, but they're not really effective and efficient. They don't have the level of systemology that American naval and land forces do. They don't have that level of confidence that comes from knowing, we're king shit of Turd Hill. We know what we're doing. We have the systems. We have the manpower. We have the confidence. That is not to say that China is an ineffective opponent. It's not. Militarily speaking, it's a tough fight, particularly because of Chinese cyber warfare capabilities. We know this. The Chinese can and will take down American intelligence networks and digital networks whenever they want to. But that does not mean that you cannot attack China's military capabilities and take them down that way. That is an avenue of attack which the God Emperor is already exploiting, and it's already showing up that China is not the monolithic power, the terrifying fighting force that everyone thinks it is. It's not. The third avenue of attack is diplomatic. China's already made this much easier on everybody. China is entering into a period of serious self-isolation because of the fallout of the Kung Flu. Xi Jinping tried to use the Belt and Road Initiative to spend huge amounts of Chinese money on infrastructure projects around the world, but it's becoming very clear that China has overreached itself. Many of those projects have never come to fruition. China has tried to acquire resources and territories in countries around the world that now no longer want the Chinese there. Whether we're talking in Pakistan, large parts of Africa, the South China Sea, the Indian Ocean, wherever you're looking, these countries are basically telling China, go away, get the hell out. Countries throughout the Asia-Pacific region now beefing up their militaries in direct response to Chinese aggression. They've all woken up. They've all realized China represents a huge threat to their national sovereignty, because China essentially claims a 3,000 kilometer wide exclusion zone, which is like the whole of the South China Sea and the East China Sea. It claims all of that as its own territory. So, South Korea, Japan, Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, they're all beefing up their military presence. India is beefing up its naval capabilities in the Andaman Islands. They're basically unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Indian Ocean. Why are they doing this? Because they recognize Chinese expansionism as a threat to their own national sovereignty. They're doing this because they understand that the Chinese want access to all of the resources of that area to fuel their economy. And if they don't get it, they may well just show up with a bunch of naval warships and take over. But unlike the US, which has many, many faults, no doubt about it, but still basically tries not to maintain an actual overseas empire. It kind of fails at that, but it tries not to maintain an overseas empire. It actually has an overseas empire, but it's a very strange one. The Chinese are much more imperialist in their ambitions, classically imperialist. They are using classic imperialist Western tactics from the 1800s to take over a lot of these countries by building railroads and ports and hospitals and roads and such. But the end goal is essentially to make it easier for up to 300 million of their own people to settle in Africa and colonize Africa, to allow their goods and services to flow more easily from these resource-rich centers to resource-poor China. That's their whole MO. But it's falling apart. And that, we come to the last avenue of attack, which is one that most people don't understand because of the opaque nature of Chinese politics. And I don't claim to understand it that well myself. But remember when I said that the PLA isn't an effective fighting force? The PLA is not China's army. It is the army of the Communist Party of China. The CCP controls the PLA. The Chinese people don't. It's not like the US Army or the US military, which pledges to uphold the Constitution of the United States and is therefore directly answerable to we, the people of the United States. The PLA is answerable to the Communist Party, and the Communist Party actually has some serious factional infighting going on right now. There is a faction of legacy holdouts from the Jiang Zemin era, and there is Xi Jinping's power base. Xi Jinping was never actually a chosen candidate from either of the two main factions. I forget what the other one's called. He was a compromise candidate, so he had to build his own power base, which is why he's gone on this huge anti-corruption campaign. He built his power base using the Chinese military and by purging Jiang Zemin officials. So the way to undermine him is to cut out that power base from under him. And that's exactly what the God Emperor is doing right now. So, since I'm running out of time, let me just point out, the Cold War with China is winnable. Anyone who tells you otherwise is really not looking at the facts on the ground. China is not some monolithic power that can easily win a prolonged economic war against the US. It will lose that war, in fact. It is the much weaker partner in that relationship. It will lose. The God Emperor is taking exactly the necessary steps to destroy China's ability to steal technology from the US and is doing exactly what he has to do to kick out Chinese spies. That's a very good thing. So don't feel like this war is unwinnable. It is winnable. The ways of winning it come to us from the past, and we should apply those lessons to the current situation such that the Chinese are contained. They go back to essentially being another nation in the community of nations, just like the US should be, and everybody can basically sleep easier at night. And that's all for me for this week. I hope you found this useful and enlightening. As I said, please head over to superbshaving.com and check out the affiliate links in the description box if you want to keep supporting what I do. This is Didact, and this was Didactic Mind, episode 40, Cold War the new Cold War.